Good afternoon. On behalf of USIP, the Jennings-Randolph Fellowship Program in particular, I'd like to welcome you all to the second in our 2007 Project Report Series. My name is Lynn Tesser. I'm a program officer here in the Fellowship Program, and I'll also be serving as the moderator. Now, each spring and summer, we invite our current senior fellows to present or give a public presentation on their research in progress, project report, in other words. And we do that for at least two reasons. First, so that we can get a good glimpse of their research, and also so that the fellows can receive feedback at, I think, a critical time in the fellowship year, a time when they've done quite a bit of research, but there's still, in most cases, a lot to be done. So this is the time when your comments and questions can really make a big difference. So we look forward to hearing those after the presentations. So it's my great pleasure to formally introduce a senior fellow, Hassan Barari, who's been with us this year working on a book that's going to provide a comprehensive assessment of Arab scholarship on Israel. We've been thrilled to have him. We're equally thrilled to have him with us today because I think he's doing work that's not only timely, but I think it's also truly groundbreaking. Now, Hassan holds a research and teaching position at the University of Jordan Center for Strategic Studies. He also serves as a columnist for a daily newspaper in Amman and continues to participate in diplomatic training for Jordan's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. He also holds a PhD in international relations from the University of Durham in England. Now, we've also invited Jeff Helsing, Deputy Director of USIP's Education Program, to serve as the commentator. He'll be commenting on a paper that's been circulated to USIP staff that features segments of Hassan's book manuscript in progress. Now, Jeff, as many of you know, in addition to his capacity as serving in his capacity as deputy director, is also one of our team of Arab-Israeli specialists. He's also been involved in efforts to consider how Israelis and Palestinians both understand and misunderstand their history as well as the quote-unquote other's history and how this affects or impacts the ability to make peace. Prior to joining USIP, Jeff had numerous academic positions, including at American University in Cairo, at Georgetown, as well as Swarthmore College, among others. Now, USIP, I think as many of you know, has done a lot of work on Arab-Israeli issues. Of course, we have our project report today. We've produced a number of special reports, copies of which are on the table outside. You can also download them from our website. I'd also draw your attention to the recently published book by former senior fellow Yoram Perry, entitled Generals in the Cabinet Room, How the Military Shapes Israeli Policy. It's on Israeli civil-military relations, and as I understand it, has been getting very good reviews. Now, for the media in the room, I'd like to offer our usual disclaimer, which is simply that Hassan's views do not necessarily reflect the views of the U.S. Institute of Peace, which does not advocate specific policies. This event will be recorded and available on the website for you to listen to as many times as you like. At this point, I'd like to formally give thanks to two research assistants working with Hassan that also helped out with this event. First, Dina Kanat. There she is. Thanks to Dina. She's currently getting her master's at George Washington University in Middle East Studies. And also to Christopher New, who is probably still out at the table out front, who's working on a master's in democracy and governance at Georgetown. So thanks very much to those two. I'd also like to ask everyone or really plead with you to turn off your cell phones and BlackBerries so that we don't have interference with the microphones and also so that the recording of the event is clear. And as far as how we'll proceed, Hassan will speak for about a half hour. Jeff will give us about 10 minutes of commentary, then we'll open it up to the floor. And if you'd like to ask a question or comment, I'd ask that you signal to me and I'll keep a running list. Okay, so with that, we'll turn it over to Hassan.
Thank you very much, Lynn Tesler, for this interesting and generous way of introducing me. And I would like also to thank the U.S. Institute of Peace for hosting me for a year to write this book, which, you know, I have it's not only something that I need to write, but I have a kind of passion with writing things on Israel, and especially how the Arabs have studied Israel historically. So my interest in this topic is derived from my own experience, actually. When I did my PhD and finished that, I went back to Jordan. So I was introduced to the Jordanian public and actually to the wider Arab public as an expert on Israel. And ever since I've been on TV and like in doing talk shows, etc., and debating the issue of Israel, and I was struck by the ignorance of the issue of Israel among experts, among scholars on Israel. I mean, here I'm referring to the Arabs. I'm not referring to the non-Arab experts on Israel. So I had a lot of debates with politicians and journalists and academics about the issue of Israel, and I was wondering why have they never got it like right, and that was actually the beginning of my interest in exploring this idea of how they have studied Israel from 1948 up until now. So this is the main question of my inquiry: is the status of Israeli studies in the Arab world? Here, when I say the Arab world, actually I refer to al-Mashriq. Al-Mashriq is Egypt, Lebanon, Palestine, Jordan, and Syria. So I will probably speak for 25 minutes to 30 minutes, and I would appreciate any feedback, especially to the main term of the book, which is Israelism, that I will introduce in a bit. So I'm not quite sure that this term has been used before or not. So if anybody has any idea about that, I would welcome any comments. I will advance three main arguments in the book. The first one is, despite the existence of a plethora of books on Israel written in Arabic, Arab scholars have not been successful in producing objective knowledge on Israel. So this is the first argument. The second one is that Israeli studies in Arabic, and here I just want to focus, emphasize one more time that it's text written in Arabic. So Israeli studies are beset by subjective projections, ideological distortions, bias, and the necessity to expose Israel rather than to explain Israel. And the third argument in the book is that Israeli studies in the Arab world are by and large informed by the Arab-Israeli conflict. So there's a huge impact of the conflict on the way the Arabs see Israel. So the main term that I use in this book, which is Israelism, Israelism, I use it to refer to a mode or a style of writing that is driven by a perceived set of ideas rooted in ideology that subordinate pure knowledge to the imperatives of the Arab-Israeli conflict and the obsession with the absolute justice of the Palestinian cause. So there is this perception among the Arabs that the Palestinian cause is just. So now, before I turn to the obstacles, I want to draw your attention to one thing, that this kind of exposition is neither to condemn Arab scholarship nor to condemn their cause, which is the Palestinian cause. And I think, and here is my political stand, I want to set it from the very beginning, that I think the Palestinians have the right to self-determination, and two-state solution is the only game in town. And for this, I think there's a kind of consensus among all would say people who are really interested in the region, and I'm not an exception. I think they have the right to self-determination, so in anything that I'm going to say should not take away anything from the Palestinian noble cause, I would say. Noble cause, they are the people who are still living under occupation, and this is the last colonial occupation on earth. The Israeli occupation of the West Bank is the last colonial occupation on earth, so this is not against them or against their cause. Now the main question is, why has this style of writing, this Israelism, prevailed in the Mashriq? I will just shed light on some of the obstacles, and then I will open the floor for discussion. The first one is, I would say in the first three decades of the conflict, since 1948 up until probably 77, 78, when Sadat made his his surprise visit to Israel, there was indifference to the Israeli to studying Israel from within. And this is very important because up until 1970, I would say that in 1970, as you remember, Israel and Egypt were fighting each other in the war of attrition. And then the Egyptian regime, Nasser regime at that time, and wanted to draft students from the university to go and fight. And there was demonstration in the university. And as Abdulmanam Said, one of the most prominent Arab scholars, told me, they were protesting and were saying that if you want to draft us, at least teach us something about Israel. And that was the first time when they introduced a course in Cairo University about Israel, and it was taught by a guy who had nothing to do with Israel. Anyway, I mean, he just probably brought in the protocol of Elder Zionism, and he started the idea and started the process of indoctrination, etc. So that was the first time ever in the Arab world that Israel was taught in one of the leading universities. And the reason for indifference to the Israeli studies from within is because of two assumptions that had prevailed during that era. The first one is there was a political and ideological conviction, or I would say illusion, that Israel was not there to stay. Israel was there to come to an end. So this is, to use the George Tenet term, that Islam dunk, you know, that Israel disappearance is Islam dunk. So it's a foregone conclusion that Israel would come to an end. And because of that, you know, if Israel was going to vanish, there was no need to study Israel from within. And they, you know, quickly they would invoke some historical events like the Crusaders and the colonialism and the Ottoman. They were all passed in the area, and they vanished. So that was the ideological, I would say, illusion about Israeli resilience in the region. The second assumption has to do with the understanding that the most important part of Israel is its foreign policy and its role of the region in the region. And Israeli role in the region was determined by the need to serve the imperial interest in the region. And for this reason, whatever happened in Israel from within, and political parties, whether Likud assume power or lose power, all of these things were not really important because it would not tell us anything about Israel itself. It's, you know, you need to understand the Brits, for example, interest in the region, or later on the American interest in the region, to understand Israeli movement in the region. And I would quote one of the well-known experts on the issue, Nasser Shamali and Hisham al-Dajani. Both of them wrote a book on called Political Parties and Blocs in Israel. And they wrote it after 1977 when Menachem Begin defeated Shimon Peres in the general election and Likud for the first time assumed power. And that was a turnabout. In Israel it's called Mahbacha, like a revolution, something was unthinkable before for the right-wing Likud to assume power. So Nasser Shamali wrote a book, and the main conclusion of the book is the following. And here I'm translating from Arabic. So many have believed when Likud assumed power that it was a full turnabout in Israeli politics. And then he keeps on, and then he said the main political parties, the main political parties in Israel are a major component of a complex network of arrangement that exists to serve the global capitalist regime. Their task is to create a conducive social and political atmosphere that places Israel in a suitable position to carry out its task in serving the global system. The Jews were assembled and dispatched to Palestine for this purpose. So, this is, I mean, this is obnoxious to come up with such kind of interpretation. I mean, there was no attempt on the part of the authors to understand the socio-economic structure of this entity called Israel at that time. And to them, and those two people were leading experts, they're not people in the French, to them it was only an issue of Likud can better serve the interests of the global imperial powers. So that was one of the one example, and I can't cite many of those books. And the second obstacle, I would say, that has to do with ideological constraints. And here, probably, it is it's very useful to remember the Gramscian's concept of hegemony, cultural hegemony. So there is a domination of certain perspectives, a domination of certain discourses that really condition the way we see things, that condition our way of interpretation. And this is the main point when I talk about ideological constraints. Hisham Sharabi, a well-known Palestinian a scholar who passed away, I think, 2 or 3 years ago, asked a question long time ago: is, can knowledge be objective, especially when it's a knowledge about the other? And he himself answered the question, and I will quote him here, saying, scholarly interpretation is never neutral or objective. It's always linked to certain theoretical and methodological perspectives that determine the course of understanding and interpretation. I concur 100% with Sharabi's answer to this question. And I think there is a clear link between the dominant perspectives and the way authors and scholars interpret events on Israel. So also when I talk about ideological constraints, I refer to three main perspectives or three main discourses that prevail up until now. The first one was the pan-Arabist one. It was after the 1948 until probably 1967. Israel was presented as only in conjunction with imperialism and colonialism. And Israel was referred to as laqita is illegitimate, or rabibat al-istamar, which is the stepdaughter of imperialism. So it's the it was never, there was no attempt to unpack the state, and to use the realist language, to unpack the state and understand Israel from within to account for its foreign policy, for example, or its movement in the region. And you would find actually no single book in Israel on anthropology of Israel. Nothing. I mean, the Israelis do not exist according to this kind of thing. It's like only dispatched to carry out their objectives and obligation to the to their masters, which is colonial powers. And here I think they are not really different from Chomsky now. He's saying probably something similar, that Israel is there to help or serve the imperialists. I don't really take issue with, I mean, there are elements in truth. I mean, the connection between imperialism and Israel was there. But to say that Israel had no independence, that the Yishuv, which is the Jewish community in Palestine before the establishment of Israel, had no internal dynamic, I think that was the problem in this kind of analysis. And the second perspective or discourse is the Islamist. And the Islamist discourse is reflected in books that published probably, I don't know, like 2 days ago. Any book, any article in media, you would find the same thing, that they are very good in invoking events that happened in history. And they use selectively some verses in the Quran in order to substantiate and vindicate their idea or their conviction that Israel will vanish, that and call it this invitability syndrome, invitability mindset, that, you know, it's a slam dunk that Israel will disappear. Even a well-known scholar in the Arab world, like Al-Masiri, Abdul Wahab Al-Masiri, who spent 25 years writing an encyclopedia on Israel. It's called Zionism and Judaism. And by the way, he doesn't know Hebrew. So he writes almost 8,000 pages about a country, about religion, and about a national movement, Zionism, without knowing the language. So, and he admitted that, Abdul Wahab al-Masiri. He's like the best known scholar. And I think there's an attempt on his part to Islamize knowledge. So if you read between lines, you can see the Islamic discourse is there in his writing, in the way he sees Israel. And but at the same time, he meets the pan-Arabists in his conclusion that Israel has a functional role in the region, which is to serve the interests of the imperial power. So, and it's really it's really very interesting to see him in the media all the time, writing for the best newspaper and appearing in Al Jazeera, and only talking about these things. Like, you know, he wrote probably 12 books that I have seen, and they all end up with the same conclusion, that Israel has a function, which is to serve the imperial power. If the imperial powers withdrew, Israel would come to an end. As simple as this. So, the third perspective or discourse, I would say the regimes. And here this is very tricky, because the regimes can be pan-Arabist or can be only state-nationalist regime. But they all use the conflict in order to justify the lack of political, I would say, participation, is to justify repression, etc. And here, in study of democracy in the Arab world, the lack of democracy, and people use paradigms. And one of them is the cultural political one, which is, and we always blame it on the Orientalists, that this is wrong because Bernard Lewis would say it's because of Islam. So Bernard Lewis was seen as Orientalist, who does not understand the region properly. So this kind of paradigm was discarded by so many people. The second one is socioeconomic one, which talks about the, you know, the evolvement of the society, etc. And it's kind of Marxist approach even. But both of them, I think there's an element of a truth in both of the approaches. But there's another one that few people talk about, which is foreign policy issues, that regimes use foreign policy in order to deflect internal opposition or resentment or frustration, in order to perpetuate the state of militarization and security, in order to put differently, in order to deprive the people from the right to participate politically. So I just want to use one example, which is about Jordan, actually. In 1989, the Jordanian economy almost collapsed. Samir, you remember probably. And so the statement coming from Jordanian official is that Jordanian economy collapsed because of Israel. I mean, as simple as this. And there was an attempt on the part of the government or the regime to use Israel in order to pacify the population. It did not work, actually. And 6 years later, King Hussein of Jordan surprised the nation by signing a peace treaty with Israel. The people were in the dark. They were not prepared for peace, and they were asked after that to support the peace. They supported peace according to opinion polls simply because they trusted the king. But it didn't work, and I think Paul Sham wrote a very interesting article about normalization, and so he can probably enlighten us about that. But the population were not really prepared, because the regimes, whether in Jordan and Syria, even worse, in Iraq, etc., they used the conflict in order to perpetuate or to enhance the legitimacy of the regime, or to corner their rivals at the regional level. And the best known example was Saddam Hussein, when in 1990 he pledged that I would burn half of Israel. And he knew that he wouldn't do it. And we knew that that was rhetoric. But at that time, he thought that this would mobilize the masses behind his schemes in the region. One of them is Kuwait, of course. The lack of development or the underdevelopment of Israeli studies could not be understood really without placing this in a wider context, which is the lack of political and academic freedom. What do I mean by academic freedom? Like, I don't think that Arab scholars can rid themselves of the dominance of the certain approaches, pan-Arabist, Islamist, or the regime. And if anyone would come up with a book that would defy these discourses, I would put himself or herself in really difficult position. And I think few people would dare to do it. So there is no really academic freedom. And also the universities, research centers punish their members. I mean, if you write a book that is not in line with the dominant approach, dominant perspective, you would pay the price. And not only that, even the Center for Strategic Studies in Jordan fired one of the scholars simply because he wrote a paper for an American think tank that is seen there as a Zionist. And this is a blatant example of lack of tolerance, lack of academic freedom. So people pay the price for only because they want to engage because they want to be different, etc. And I don't want to name names, but like some of my friends know the story very well, and this is an example of the lack of tolerance on part of research centers that actually do a lot of research on Israel as well. And another one, another under this category, I would also mention the that the archives has yet to be opened, and that's why Arabs have failed to match their Israeli counterpart, the new historians. New historians like Bernie Morris, Avi Slaim, Ilan Pepe from Haifa University, and Flapan Samha, and all of them, they come up with a narrative that really challenged the official Zionist narrative of 1948. And the Arabs just picked these ideas to vindicate their own claim that Israel was the one to blame. I'm not here defending Israel. I think Israel was to blame for something, but at the same time, there was no attempt on part of the Arab scholars to revise their official narratives, actually, not one, narratives, because the main narrative is against Israel, but there is sub-narratives, which is in the context of their rivalries and competition. There's no attempt at that. I mean, you can find really well scholarly book about the 1948 war up until 1990. I mean, the first one, ironically, is came from a Jordanian, Slimane al-Moussa, who only wrote that book in order to somehow to defend King Abdullah's role in Palestine in 1948, because he was attacked by the Arabs at that time, that he was collaborating with the Zionists. When he was the only one who really succeeded in securing part of Palestine, the West Bank, etc. So it's also this could be only understood within the context of internal Arab politics. So another obstacle was the conflict itself. I mean, it is really difficult to imagine that an Arab author can write anything on Israel dispassionately without taking the conflict into account, the impact of the conflict and the mindset. The way Israel was established that entailed the uprooting of Palestinians, whether they were kicked or not. We have refugees in Jordan, in Syria, and Lebanon, Egypt, and even in Gaza and the West Bank. And they are like a living example that keep reminding people what happened in 1948. And the common narrative among the Arabs up until now is that they were expelled. The idea of ethnic cleansing and transfer is rooted in their collective memory and collective mindset. So for those people, it's really difficult. I mean, I don't blame them sometimes. It's difficult for them to write without taking this into account. So the role of the conflict is very important. They see everything through this prism, the prism of the conflict. And also there was in 1950s and 60s, the regimes were trying to instill certain ideas about Israel in order to win over Israel at the international level in the PR war. And because of that, the role of authors and scholars and even translators is not to write on Israel, to explain Israel, to explain what is going on in Israel. They write only to expose, delegitimize, dehumanize Israel. So that is the point. Because it's like a weapon, it's like a rifle. So instead of fighting Israel in a rifle, you fight Israel while you write. And in the 60s, for example, there were a few books in Israel. And at that time, as Abdul Munim Said put it, it was a kind of pan-national filthiness to write Israel. Israel is something dirty, you can't touch it. If you touch it, you need probably to take shower. So writing is that in this way. And then 1967 and even 1948, people paid a really high price, and that was because of their ignorance. So back to the idea of the role of authors and translators, and I just want to pick on this because it's so interesting. I myself spent 3 years in Israel doing Hebrew, and I went back to Jordan like a peacock, like I know Hebrew. And that's where I met Debbie, by the way. That was in Israel. And you, Debbie. Debbie, right?
No. Me?
Oh, okay, then I'm confused. Okay, I'm confused. So I came back to Jordan. So I was talking to one of the well-known translators, Ghad Saadi. And I read the book for Asher Sasser. He is the leading Israeli expert on Jordan, about the well-known Jordanian Prime Minister, Wasfatel, who was assassinated by the Palestinians in 71, I think, 71. So I saw the translation, and he omitted two chapters, not two words, not two sentences, not two paragraphs, two chapters. He did not translate them. So when I asked Ravi, I said, so why did you remove two chapters? He said, because of censorship, I can't pass it. And I said, this is one example. I read another book also in Hebrew, and I compared it to to Arabic. A book written by the late Israeli Moshe Zak from Ma'ariv. The book was Hussein Osei Shalom, Hussein Makes Peace. And I was just, you know, going through the book, and I was struck by the distortion. I mean, and Ghad's Hebrew is fantastic. You know, don't get me wrong, he's great. But his role is not to explain the whole truth, but also to color this with kind of ideology. And in each of the translated book, you will find an introduction. It's called the translator's introduction, which is actually longer than the introduction of the original writer, and even longer than the first chapter. It's like 40 pages sometimes. He's just telling us one thing, that the writer of the book is a Zionist, is a liar, is X and Y and Z, is all of this, and Israel is A, B, C, D, all of these stereotypes, things, and then you read it. So read it with this in your mind. So he is warning the reader that this book is written by a Zionist, and a Zionist is not a nice word in the Arab world. So if I were like a normal a layman in the street, I want to pick a book for Golda Meir memoir and read this introduction, I would not read the book, because that's enough. So this is one thing. Also, you will find a lot of conspiracy theorists in the writings on Israel, and I can cite examples, but I will skip this because it is not actually confined to the Arab writing. Also, it is worldwide phenomena. Let me focus now on the, after Madrid, the Palestinians signed the Oslo Agreement, and the Jordanians signed the peace treaty, and also Egypt before signed the peace treaty in 1979. And there was a golden opportunity for Arab scholars to interact with Israelis. But here I want to talk about the logistical constraints, which is that contributed to the lack of development of Israeli studies in the Arab world. One of them is the language, Hebrew. I mean, you will be surprised if I tell you that 80% of specialists in Israel do not speak Hebrew, apart from some journalists and apart from Israeli Arabs like Elias Shafani, Habib Tahwaji, those people who actually left in the 60s and joined the PLO, and they established a department to study Israel, and they're the only one who knew Hebrew. And sometimes it is fascinating that if I tell you the story that I had a meeting with experts on Israel in Jordan in 2002, and a leading expert at that time, an Egyptian one, said that actually there is no need to learn Hebrew, because we can study the German society without having any knowledge of German. But at that table, I was the only one who spoke Hebrew, so I didn't want to press it, because they would have said, oh, because he knew Hebrew, so that's, I said, okay. But there's no feeling that they should put effort in that. Also, going, visiting Israel, you know, interacting with people, here we have the problem that Kursham wrote in his article about normalization. So, and few people would like to be seen as normalizers. You know, normalizer is like not really a good word in Egypt, or even in Jordan. But what I'm trying to do, I mean, these are the obstacles that I shed light on. I'm trying to do is not only to unmask the inherent bias in Arab scholars studying, but I want to also create an awareness among the epistemic community, among the the Arab authors and scholars and even journalists to see that there is a serious problem here, which is we have not been successful in studying Israel. And I also hope that I will stir a debate among the specialists. And not only that, I will be very constructive. It's not, as I said at the beginning, I'm not going only to condemn. I'm not condemning, actually. It's not to expose. But I will try to come up with a mechanism of how to bring about an Arab approach to study Israel that takes into account all of these peculiar things like the perpetuation of the conflict, lack of peace, and ascendance of right wings in both the Israelis and the Palestinians. But at the same time, use the social sciences approaches to study Israel. Before I conclude, I want to say that the picture is not that gloomy. I mean, there are some good scholars, and I have to mention names now because they deserve to be mentioned. And I will mention one, and I think there are three of them. But one is Khalil Shiqaqi, a Palestinian, and I mention him because he's Palestinian, like people under occupation, and still he is one of the few who can write something very objective. And anyway, being objective is something of is a relative thing, but he wrote the book on the Israeli public opinion from, he called it hesitant public opinion, and he traced the idea of two-state solution, how it originated in the public from 1994 up until 2002. That was the book. And he used the social sciences, and he used all opinion polls published by Tami Center from Tel Aviv University, and he introduces analysis that you cannot trace any shred of ideology or anything. It's really pure. I mean, if you don't see the name, you would say that it's written by a German, it's written by probably a Canadian, I wouldn't say American, a Canadian, etc. So there are really good good scholars. Ahmad Jad from Ahram Center is doing a great job, I think. Probably his weakness is that he doesn't know Hebrew, but his writing is at least balanced. And he employs social sciences approaches. And I conclude there. Thank you for listening.
Great. Thank
That's
you
half
very
an
much.
Hour.
Okay, good. Thank you. Okay, so now we'll turn to Jeff Helsing for about 10 minutes of comments, and then we'll open it up to the floor, okay?
Thank you, Lynn. Thank you very much, Hassan. It's a pleasure to be part of this program, not only because of my interest in education in the Middle East as part of my work for the U.S. Institute of Peace, but as Lynn mentioned, I taught at the American University in Cairo for a few years back in the mid-1990s. I had the opportunity for 3 years of teaching a course on Israeli politics and foreign policy, a course that came about because of the overwhelming interest of the student body there at the American University in Cairo. And I was struck by the tremendous hunger of young, predominantly Arab students for knowledge about Israel. But there are a lot of obstacles to this, as Hassan points out, and one of them embodies this. It was a situation that occurred when I was there. I was advising three graduate students on their master's theses that were focused on Israeli foreign policy. So being a good advisor and academic that I was, I arranged for them to go to Israel, and I was going to accompany them, go to Israel and interview senior members of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, from Yossi Beilin on down. And I arranged this. I talked to the Egyptian Foreign Ministry. They were very encouraging. We arranged the long visa process at the Israeli embassy in Egypt, and we traveled over land to Israel, and these three students were stopped and detained at the border, and they were not allowed into Israel. They were not allowed by the Ministry of Interior, and they spent almost 24 hours in detention at the border. as you can imagine, I felt a little bit guilty for having put them in this position. But what I remember most was one of the students' comments after this was, how can my country have so little faith in my integrity and independence of mind? That is, the possibility that in fact a young Egyptian scholar would go to Israel and the result would, they would simply be brainwashed. That there was no confidence in the critical thinking skills or no confidence in the ability of their younger generation to in fact divorce what they heard from becoming sort of a propagandist for the enemy. And I think that really embodies one of the major obstacles that Hassan has properly identified in the challenge for Arab scholarship on Israel. I think, after having read his paper, I think what he's done is a terrific job of analyzing the paucity of Arab scholarship in this era. And as a commentator, and as somebody who works both in this area and works here at USIP, I would like to challenge you to expand on what you've done, because I think you've made a terrific start. But I think it would also be very useful in your book to actually make the case for why it's important to understand Israel. That is, to make a self-interested argument. That is, Arab populations, Arab education, is not well served by not understanding Israel. And I think there's a very valid case to be made, and I think you have touched upon some of that, but I think that could be one of the real additional contributions of the book that you are writing. And I say that as an American, as an educator, who in a sense takes it for granted that developing or pursuing more knowledge about something or some place or some people is actually a good. But I think we may have to do more work to make the case in societies where critical thinking about a number of issues, not just about Israel, where critical thinking is not necessarily always seen as a good. And I think you do a nice job of, I think, building on what Edward Said does in his criticism of Orientalism. In fact, that if you make the case that knowledge is power, or that scholarship has an agenda, then make the case for knowledge and critical thinking and scholarship serving an agenda that advances both Arab education, but also Arab policies with respect to Israel or the West, or whatever it is one wants to advance. I want to highlight a few of the particular critical points that Hassan makes. The first I sort of alluded to, and that is, it's very hard to be an independent scholar in the Arab world. Academic integrity, academic credentials are often valued by the way a scholar conforms to a specific paradigm or ideology. So that independence in critical thinking is problematic, as your colleague who lost his job can attest to. It's hard to be a scholar of Israel, a scholar on Israel, because there's an automatic assumption that you become a scholar for Israel. And I think getting people to think beyond the notion that one can become, that as a scholar you become an advocate for whatever it is you're studying, and that has to be broken down. One of the reasons why that exists, though, as you correctly alluded to, is the obstacle of legitimization. Does the study of Israel give Israel legitimacy. In other words, if you study Israel, are you, in effect, helping Israel? And so I guess the question one has to ask is, can better academic and public knowledge about Israel serve the Palestinian cause? I mean, if that is part of the agenda, how does normalization actually fit into that? Is the cause undermined by normalization? Or, in a sense, I would raise the question that, does ignoring Israel academically, does that weaken Israel, or does that weaken you? And I think that needs to be brought very much to the fore in challenging Arab scholars. I also think that even if one doesn't agree with some of the theses that are put forward, and you highlight some of them, but I remember one in particular that you looked at, which was looking at the diversity of political parties in Israel. And one of the conclusions was that the fact that there is a diversity of political parties in Israel is simply to control or pacify competing interests in Israel in order to serve imperialist Western interests. Even if that's the case, even if that's your thesis, is it still not important to understand what those interests are, how that co-optation is accomplished, by looking inside Israeli society? The other thing I would conclude with is that one of the challenges in this project, I think, will also be to get, at least to my way of thinking, Arab scholarship to think about how they don't do enough critical analysis of their own histories and their own societies. As I mentioned when I taught this course on Israel, I thought it would be very useful for the students as they were reading predominantly Israeli texts and documents for this course. I thought it would be very useful to have a companion Palestinian text or a companion set of Palestinian articles about the same historical period or the same subject matter. And I was struck not only by the fact there's almost nothing that's been translated into English, but there's very little about the other narrative, if you will. And I think that's it's not just that there's a failing in scholarship about Israel, there's a failing in scholarship about many of the issues in which Arab countries or Arab societies engage with Israel or have a conflict with Israel. And I think the more that can be promoted there, I know our institute has done so. We sponsored a fellowship of Philip Matar, which was to be a sort of, if not revisionist, certainly a critical history of Palestine and in its role in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. I would also like to put a plug in for Paul Sham's book with his colleagues Waleed Salem and Benjamin Pogrund, as well as at the secondary school level, the Peace Research Institute in the Middle East, their secondary school history text, because here you have scholarship being developed, history being written by Palestinians that is in a way equal to as scholarship with Israeli perspectives. These are not common narratives, but shared or in some ways parallel narratives that do a lot to advance Palestinian an Arab scholarship in this area. Because I think the fact that there is little Israeli scholarship in the Arab world, that there's no revisionist Arab school of thought, as you point out, does a real disservice to Arab education and Arab students. If they can't develop critical thinking about Israel, I'm not convinced they will be good critical thinkers about other issues, particularly their own issues internally as well. The final thing I will just raise is, and I don't know whether it's too far outside the bounds of your project, but you did mention it, so I would emphasize it, and that is there's also a critical need to influence journalism in the region as well. I think a lot of public education, as we sort of view it, is greatly influenced by the lack of understanding about Israel on the part of journalists as well. And I think that's another important area to consider. And if nothing else, maybe that's for your second book. So thank you very much.
Oh, great. Thank you, Jeff. Well, let's open it up to the floor. This gentleman at the corner was first. Let's take Paul second, and then this lady third. And then we'll go on, okay?
Mine is just a very minor detail. I didn't hear your description of Israelism. You started the outset.
We can, if you want, we can have the first three questions and comments first,
yeah,
and
sure.
Then you can answer.
Yeah.
So, if you want to.
Okay. A couple of comments and questions. First, thanks very much for a groundbreaking effort in this. This is something that I've been interested in for many years and don't have the Arabic, remotely to do it. So I think this is something that is enlightening on a lot of levels. We've met each other many times in Jordan and in Israel, and certainly my experience confirms what you're saying. I wanted to ask, though, a couple of things, whether you feel, as I do to some degree, that the situation has changed, because certainly when I've spoken to many Jordanian professors and journalists, I was surprised at the sophistication of level of knowledge of Israeli politics. One brief anecdote, a very prominent columnist who I won't mention once, who asked me once to pick up a biography of Jabotinsky in Israel and bring it over to him. I saw a column by him which was lambasting Israel and saying all sorts of things, and then I happened to meet him that afternoon. And he gave me a totally different analysis of what he said. In other words, and I think this is very, very common, that it's not pure fear. It's just that to maintain a social position, to maintain his everything the way people thought about him, he had to make an automatic distinction between what he knew from his own knowledge and what he had to say. I also think there are several, we did a project at the Truman Institute on journalism, you mentioned that, and which showed in the same way that both sides, the journalists knew much more than they would say, but they felt it necessary to express themselves as their audience expected, that per you talk to them, they had a much greater knowledge, but they needed to write for their audience. There are other journalists who do that. Rami Khoury, of course, who I believe was here and is very well known. He writes primarily in English,
yeah,
of course, and he grew up in this country, and he has a very sophisticated knowledge of Jews and of Israel. Finally, the other question is, I wonder if you could talk about differences, briefly, in differences in Arab countries. My experience is largely in Jordan, and of course, what I'm talking about are personal. People know one thing and write something else. And of course, with Palestinians, there are many Palestinians who have a very sophisticated knowledge of Israel, but you generally won't find that in scholarly works about Israel in Arabic. But also, if you would talk about the difference between, say, what has appeared or hasn't appeared at all in more distant countries, Saudi Arabia, Syria, I would assume there was very little, but I'd be very interested in hearing your comments on it.
Okay, thank you. Let's have our final question before we move on. And one thing I forgot to ask is if you can just identify yourself and state your affiliation. Thank you.
My name is Rania, and I'm a graduate student at Georgetown University. My question is for both Professor Hudson and Dr. Hudson and Dr. Barari. Specifically, I've heard you outline the main issues or constraints on the Arab Street about being able to do some critical scholarly work on Israel. And I'm wondering if you can comment maybe more specifically about the role of outside research, maybe for the internet, or maybe research other people have done.
Outside what? Sorry, I can't hear you.
If you could comment a little bit about the role of research done by other people that may be accessible to Arabs through the internet, or maybe through Al Jazeera, for example, in terms of debates, etc. And if you think that's playing any role, even if it's small, in terms of helping people understand the other side. And then the other question is, if you can, you talked about the value of education, and I'm wondering if you can give some specifics about what issues you think would be valuable for Arabs to understand about Israeli society. And maybe if you could give examples of how of things that Israelis do well in terms of scholarly work about the Arab world, and maybe an example that might help bridge the communication to the other side.
Well, thank you very much for all of the comments and questions. And I would start with Jeff, and thank you very much for drawing my attention to a very important thing, which is why is it important to study Israel? And I think this is, as also you answered yourself, which is good, that you made it easier for me, which is, you know, knowledge is power. I mean, and I just want to mention something that on the eve of 1948 wars, and if you look at the debates, and the books that published immediately after the war, it was nothing about the Yishuv, which is the Israeli, the Jewish community in Palestine before the establishment of Israel. And the Israeli Haganah, which was a well-trained army, was referred to as gangs, you know, like a bunch of gangs, and there was no illusion. And they knew, or the perception at that time that we use the word Mbardi in Arabic. You know Mbardi, Samir. So Mbardi is like, you know, any fighter. You can bring like 400 people, a bunch of them from any tribe, and go to the Jewish settlements in Kibbutzim, and you can drive them in the sea. So there were no attempt on them to really understand the other side. And when war happened, they were surprised that this issue, which was tiny compared to Egypt, for example, was managed to put in field more than 95,000 well-trained soldiers with the most advanced weapon back then, and where Arabs were really fragmenting and fighting each other, who would take what, etc. There were no understanding, and I think they paid the price for this lack of knowledge. And when you move on up until 1967, you know, the defeat, and I'm sure that Nasser had a much better understanding of Israel, and he did not want war, but he was dragged by the atmosphere, by the pressure, by the his image, by his own ideology, that he was dragged and closed Tehran straight, and then he set things in motion, and the war happened, and he lost. And it's only after that, actually, when another approach in studying Israel, I did not mention everything, what actually is spearheaded by Palestinians themselves, is that know your enemy approach. So it's then when people were trying to understand everything about Israel in terms of facts, like Likud won power, like Labour had something like 22 seats, for example, and all of these things. But interpretation, and here is the link that Sharabi made in a very well manner, a link between one's own perspective and interpretation. This is the biggest problem. It remains ideological. It remains driven by the need to fight Israel rather than the need to explain Israel. And that's why, even after 1995, and you pointed out correctly, Hulsham, that you met Rami Khoury. Rami Khoury never wrote in Arabic, actually. And his Arabic is not there, I think. I mean, I spoke to him. He's a good friend of mine, and his Arabic is weak. It's nothing to take against him. Yeah, but I enjoy his writings on Israel. But again, what I'm examining in the book is text on Israel in Arabic. So I know they're good, like Walid al-Khalidi, for example, wrote beautiful books on Israel, on the conflict. And you disagree with some interpretation, but they are scholarly documented. There's, you find an approach and methodology. Epistemologically speaking, you can't argue a lot with that. But he writes only in English. So the normal readers in the Arab world, the layman, would not have an access to his book. Actually, if you go to Amman downtown and see the kiosk, the people selling books, and in the book you can buy, I think, in 5JD, which is $7, you can buy probably 10 books in your way, and they're all about the torture of Muslims in the grave after they die, and all of these kind of superstitious things. And books in Israel, really bad quality in terms of writing, production, print, whatever, you can buy them, or probably you can buy one, get two free. I don't know what is the deal. But there is an atmosphere that would help perpetuate the level of mystification, the level of disinformation. It's there in Jordan, definitely in Egypt. In Syria, it's worse, by the way. The only thing that the Syrians did, actually, they established Mu'assasat al-Ard, which is the land corporation, or the land foundation. And they brought in some Israelis, Israeli Arabs, to work, and they were serving the regime. Writing is to serve the regime, and this foundation came to an end, I think, 10 years ago. And they stopped. After the Oslo Agreement, they stopped producing anything, and then they were scattered, and some of them went back to with the PLO, going back to the territory. So I am not really aware of what is written in Saudi Arabia. I did not do any effort because I have not seen even any article written by a Saudi, apart from the public thing, which mainly they repeat whatever we say. Like in Egypt, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, we are the four countries that fought Israel, that made peace with Israel. So we are the one to be, we're their model. And what a good model anyway. So you won't find books. But I checked one of the centers in the in Emirates, which is the strategic center. I found one study on the Labour Party. To be honest, it was a good study. Good study because it documented the constitution of the party. It talks about the history of the party in terms of power, how many times they assumed power. It had zero interpretation, and that's why probably I can't judge the book, because in terms of fact, it was correct. Interpretation, there was no interpretation. It was a kind of descriptive study. Your question about Israelism, I said it's like a side of writing. So whenever we have an Arab writer want to write in Israel, immediately come to the fore set of ideas rooted in ideology, driven by the imperative to dehumanize, delegitimize, expose Israel rather than to explain Israel. And also this style of writing is influenced by the prism of the conflict, the need to hold your ground, that we are fighting Israel still. Israel is an enemy state. And even in a country like Jordan, there was an opinion poll in 1999. 80% of Jordanians see Israel as enemy. So this is something. This is a phenomenon that need to be studied. Like a country that signed a peace treaty with Israel, and the king of Jordan was a pioneer in terms of contact with Israelis from 1963, and he did not conceal that. In 1996, he gave Avi Shlaim an interview where he admitted that I met Yaakov Herzog in 1963 in September. And he was not in the defensive. On the contrary, I think he did very well. I mean, in meeting the Israelis secretly in 1973 and 69, I think he did very well to serve the interests of his own country, and trying to convince the Israelis that peace is the only way. I think he did a great job. Now, with the hindsight, I would commend what he did. But at that time, when they were released in the paper that King Hussein was meeting the Israelis, he was not seen as an Arab patriot or Arab nationalist. He was seen as, with a big question mark about his pan-Arabist credentials at that time. And I'm not defending him because he was the king of my country, but I am very trying to be objective because I'm prone to peace, and I think he did the right thing. And others did that. I mean, even Nasser had some contacts with Israelis. Sadat has contacted Israel. I mean, the visit to Israel was not, he sat and dreamt that night and he said, okay, I'm going to Israel. No, Tuhami, Moshe Dayan met in Morocco a couple of times, and they laid the ground for the visit. So the contacts were there. Even go back to the 1930s and 40s, the Syrian National Assembly had a very close contact with the Jewish Agency. So the Arabs did it in different ways, but people sometimes pay the price, and I think the Hashemite paid the price in 1951 when he was assassinated, King Abdullah the First, and King Hussein paid the price in terms of his credential, but he regained it with the first Gulf War in 1990, and a little bit he moved with the Arabs. And what I want to say is that and here back to you, Jeff, I think where the Arabs didn't get it right when they confuse between the legitimacy of Israel as a state and the legitimacy of Israel as a topic. to be studied. And that's why they thought once we write books in Israel, we confer kind of legitimacy on the otherwise illegitimate entity. So I think I got it all. I mean, if I miss anything, I'm sorry.
Okay, let's move on to you. If you can identify yourself.
I'm Danimov from Study,
apology.
From the Transatlantic Institute in Brussels. I have two intense questions. My first is, did the framework and content of Israel Study change during times when there was more of a hope for reconciling the Israel-Palestine issue? And second is, do the states which have signed peace agreements with Israel differ in terms of the content of Israel studies from those that have not? And actually, a third question is, I know that Azmi Bishara has been all over the news recently, but in terms of understanding of the Israeli Arab community, if you could explain a bit more and go into depth about that, I'd appreciate it.
What do you want me to talk about, Azmi?
Not much, but knowledge of the status of the Israeli Arabs.
Julie, let's get another question.
Stanley Kober with the Cato Institute. Where do the jobs come from? Who would employ these people? Government? Private industry? If you're going to train people, something you have to have. I'm looking at this from my experience during the Soviet days, people studied everywhere in the West. When they count them down, the jobs disappeared. Where do you go? Other words, where do you go? So, who would be employed?
Okay, finally, Ginny.
Just a brief question. I'm Ginny Vivier from USIP, and I'm wondering, I know this is outside the scope of your study, but I'm wondering if you have a sense comparatively that the Israelis have been more successful in achieving the kind of objectivity and critical thinking about the Arab world kind of as a counterpart to your study.
Okay. Thanks. I think that's enough for the moment.
Okay, I'll start in the reverse. Whether the Israelis were more successful, I think yes. I mean, there are some scholars in Israel who wrote things and were driven by ideology, expansionist kind of Zionist ideology, and I disagree with their interpretation, disagree with the agenda, and they are exactly as Nasser Shamali. And some of them who adopted the Orientalist approach in studying the Arab societies, and I think they completely missed the point. So they're really bad scholarship, Israeli scholarship on the Arab world, but at the same time you would find like a high percentage of good scholars who studied the Arab countries in somehow objective way, in more objective, or at least they employed the social sciences disciplines and epistemologies in a very successful manner. I can mention people like Asher Sasser wrote books on Jordan, and I think the way he wrote about Jordan is much better than most Jordanians write about Jordan, and I have to admit that. His book on West Bethel is a masterpiece. His book on Jordan, the pivotal state, is a masterpiece. Yossi Nevo from Haifa University wrote about Jordan. He was a very good scholar, and Shimon Shamir wrote about Egypt, and those guys are formidable. Like, you know, I admire them very much, but at the same time, education in Israel is not really, it's nationalist. I mean, and if you touch on the religious one, go to Merkaz Arab in Jerusalem, and you can see that it's an industry of hatred toward the Arabs. So, and they themselves produce the most extremist people, like, you know, Gush Emunim and those who initiated the process of settlement that sabotaged the peace process. And you have different people, but. But the percentage of good scholars much higher than the Arabs. And also the new historian. Now, whether you agree or disagree with them, and they managed to stand up to the official national Zionist narrative, and they said it's wrong, based on archives. So, and we don't have this opportunity in the Arab world because we don't have archives. Like, if I want to study the Jordanians' involvement in the war of 1948, where can I get archives from? You know, King Abdullah II would definitely say no. And I can understand. And if you go to Egypt, they wouldn't. And even if they release, it would be selectively in order to praise the new regime and to corner the older one. So it's being used politically. Who employs scholars? That is a question. universities and government sometimes, and people, activists, political parties, with an agenda, like probably the sole agenda is to fight Israel, liberate Palestine from the Mediterranean to the river. So those kind of people who, or sometimes, you know, I mean, I became expert in Israel because I was in, A, I was interested, B, I was, my generation came after the peace treaty, and we didn't have probably the historical baggage that others had. And I was employed by the university, that is governmental. My work, sometimes censored, sometimes not. And so it's government, universities, those who fund
universities
the...
Universities are funded by the government, right?
They're funded by the government, yeah. Yeah. But if you ask me how much money they put in funding Israeli studies, I would say very little.
What about the
Mukhabarat? They have their own people. They have their own people doing their own studies, and but it's I mean, I don't blame them if they didn't get it right, because George Tenet didn't get it right. So it's something universal. And they have their own people, and they don't even consult scholars. I mean, I was never summoned by the Mukhabarat to brief them. Never. I mean, I was some the foreign minister of Jordan would ask my opinion about something on Israel, but the Mukhabarat, no way. Because they know it all, and I think they have their own links with the Israeli Mossad, so it's taken care of. Azmi Bishara, the Arab Israeli, the scholars coming from Israel, the Arabs, I think they're good. Majd al-Hajj wrote beautiful things about the Russian immigrants. Nur Musalha, he wrote something that is revisionist from an Israeli point of view, but based on archives, he employed social sciences, and he's really good. You disagree with some of his interpretation, but all in all, you can't say that. You can't discard this book as one of... Let me just mention one book, like in 1954 up until 1959, the regime in Egypt, Nasser, decided to educate the public about Israel. So they had a series called We Chose For You. Even the title is a patriarch, like We Choose For You What To Read. You know? And he wrote the introduction of, I think, a couple of them. And one of them, Zionism. The cover of the book was Zionism. So you see Zionism and the Star of David. And you see a snake, which is Zionism, of course, snake, and hissing poison, and the poison is in the form of a flag. So if you look at the cover of the book, it's a clear indictment to Israel, to the movement, the Zionist movement, etc. And you can understand that, you know, they were in war. I mean, but these are the kind of books that was produced in Egypt, and at a time when Egypt was more advanced than the rest of the Arab world in terms of universities, etc. And you compare this to the Nur Musalha, even Azmi Bishara. Azmi Bishara wrote a book about Amid the Intifada. And you know, Azmi Bishara is a pan-Arabist. He has his own ideology. But he was correct in two counts. A, in terms of facts, he mentioned them properly. Interpretation, I think I agree with probably 90% of his account of how things evolved. In one chapter, he wrote about his own thing. Now you can understand that he was also a politician and activist being persecuted by the Israeli security services. And you can understand that. Azmi Bishara is a different case. First of all, he thinks that he is the only Israeli Arab who can stand up to the Israelis, that he is up to them intellectually, not only up to them intellectually, even superior. And he believes in that. And he understands Zionism very well, and he understands Israeli politics very well. He was a Knesset member for 11 years. So, I mean, if you disagree with his ideology and some of his writing, but the guy is a formidable scholar.
So, I bet you on thinking more about the perception and understanding of the Israeli Arab community within Israeli studies in the Middle
Eastern countries. Okay. Well, they were actually ignored for a long time. I mean, I haven't seen really articles or books on them, apart from the one written by Aziz Haider Adel Manna, Israeli Arab themselves, published in the early 1990s. I published an article about Israeli democracy where I focused on the status of Arabs in Israel. And Abdul Wahab al-Masiri wrote, I think, an article on them, but in the context of attacking Israel, not explaining their situation. And the PLO tried to use them, politically speaking. Tried to use them, but I think they were ignored. Actually, and here it's very interesting that they were not trusted by the Arabs for a long time. They were not seen really pan-Arabists for a long time because they used to vote for the Zionist party at that time because they were under the military directory from up until 1966. And when they started their own parties, it was late 70s and early 80s. So up until then, they were not seen really as Arabs. And they were not trusted by the Israelis. So I think they were the biggest losers in the whole conflict.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Let me just
I just wanted to add something and more. Also go back to a question that Ron asked. And that is the question of other sources that can be utilized. And I think there's a lot of sources and resources, I suppose, about all of this subject matter. The question, I suppose, is what's the value of resources coming from within? And there's lots of things that can be translated into Arabic, and lots of things that are translated into Arabic. But I think in some cases, if you have the United States Embassy in a particular country that's sponsoring a program that's translating scholarly works on Israel or the Middle East into Arabic, that just sort of reinforces, I suppose, Edward Said's point. So the real value, I think, of what Hassan's doing is sort of trying to spark a discussion, a debate, or inspire his colleagues or the larger society in Arab countries to, in a sense, develop more critical scholarship. The one thing I will promote this again, this Peace Research Institute in the Middle East, while it's aimed at secondary school students, it's printed in all three languages, and soon there will be a website. The value of it is that there's a Palestinian narrative about history here, and they take the same time periods that are common to Israeli and Palestinian history, and then they have parallel historical narratives. And what's, I think, valuable here is that there's a strong Palestinian narrative that was developed jointly, written by Palestinians, but refined in discussion with Israelis. And the same thing with the Israeli narrative. And it's the product of really trying to, in a sense, both promote but understand the history of the other. And I think the value in something like this is that it shows Palestinian scholarship standing side by side with Israeli scholarship. And I think the value of promoting that shows that one can do this in a world that, in a sense, acknowledges and allows a place for the Israeli narrative but gives equal place to the Palestinian narrative. And as I said, probably in the fall sometimes this will actually be an electronic version and not just the print version.
Okay, let's go for a final round of questions. I saw Steve and then you, and there are a couple hands in the back. Okay, so we'll take four more, and if you can answer them in about a minute or two, then we'll close. Okay, so start with Steve.
I just want to follow up on your question and something that Jeff touched on, and that's the changes in the Arab world with regard to Israel studies. During the peace process or back in the 90s. You mentioned Khalil Shikaki and his work, and there are a number of other Palestinian groups now that are specifically focused on Israel studies. You mentioned the Al-Ahram Center. And Khalil has been around for a long time. The Al-Afram Center program has been around for a long time. What is the nature of their reach in the Arab world? And has there been any impact on other efforts to open up the space or legitimize the study of Israel?
Thank you.
Okay, my name is Marvin from the American Jewish Community Berlin office. You just mentioned and described this book cover, and you just talked about competing narratives and how to reconcile narratives. I would be interested because the Muslim community in Europe often gets the information on Israel through Arab media and Arab sources, and that results in a very different understanding of the Holocaust. That often does not relate at all to the European discourse on the Holocaust, and also transports anti-Semitic stereotypes. And I wanted to know, is that also part of your research that you look at how the Holocaust is perceived by Arab scholars?
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks. And then moving on.
I'm wondering how easy is it for a young Arab scholar, say from the University of Damascus, from Peace Saudi University or Aqsa University, to actually go to Israel, travel to Israel, and spend a couple of years there, learn Hebrew, and go back home and, you know, and write a study about Israeli politics, Israeli society. How easy is the process, and what sort of resources are available, and what sort of obstacles are there?
Okay, we have one more question.
Just a merciful for them, just stepping outside, sitting and going back to what Johnny mentioned, and with regards to the role of journalism, given that Al Jazeera constantly invites Israeli scholars and officials, and then Al-Manar as well, surprisingly. Started Hebrew broadcasting, and there's emphasis on language, on practice to learn the language as well. And the goal that would play in maybe opening up an opportunity that would eventually get to academia.
Okay, thank you. I think that's all the time for questions we have. You know, answer them and present any concluding comments that you can. We'll probably go over a little over to maybe 5 minutes past. So please.
Okay, Steve. There's an outreach definitely when people like Azmi Bshara, Khalil Shiqaq comes and say there is a need to study Israel from within. It makes a big difference now. The issue of Israel. To study Israel is legitimate now. It was not that legitimate in the 50s, 60s. There is a marked change after the Madrid process. But still, the obstacles are still there. The ideological constraints, the logistical constraints, the conflict itself are still there. The Holocaust, how it's perceived, it is really good news, probably, that the Holocaust is not denied by the experts. Abdul Wahab al-Masiri wrote about this, and he is the most probably ideological. He said the Holocaust did happen. The protocol of Elder Zionism was a lie. It was never put by the Jewish community, whatever. So on this, I think they did good. How is it easy, Hisham, for an Arab to go and study in Israel? I don't think that the Israelis would say no. I think they would welcome that. On the contrary, they would use it. The sign of normalization and sign of, politically it would be used, and I myself was used when I was there happily, and I volunteered that. but the repercussion of their political life and even their career life would be difficult when they go back to Saudi Arabia and work in King Abdulaziz University, and they say, "I was just with Shlomo Ganur," for example. You know, I don't think that it would be received well in Saudi Arabia.
So the real problem is the fact that those people would not be able to get the funding or get the resources to the countries to go to Israel and to go to...
No, the funding, if you want funding, I think the Israeli Foreign Ministry would help. there's a program. I'm not being funny, but there's a program that would fund, encourage and fund people to come. Go Hebrew University, 1,500 students. Yearly would go on to Rotherburg School and study, etc. They would love it. And if a Saudi guy come from a Bin Laden family, for example, want to study in Israel, they will welcome that, definitely. But I'm telling you that the problem is not on the Israeli side. The problem is on the Arab side. Even the Egyptian side, when, you know, they signed peace treaty, and it's really very difficult for people to go and study there. And I know one of my friends that I met in Ulpana Kiva, an Egyptian, when he went back, he was harassed by the intelligence, by the... So, the last question, role of journalism, you know, I probably missed your question, sorry. Can you do it again, please?
Those that are unrelated to the Palestinian group conflict as well. And then there is interest. I mentioned Amanat as an example, because they're saying to govern.
Yeah, the Hebrew stuff. Yeah,
yeah, but they still have people who look at the pressure. So this says something about maybe about the community.
Yeah, this is, well, first of all, this is beyond the scope of my book, but it's a very good thing to examine the role of media and how, and Al Jazeera is doing, I think, is something pioneering. They don't listen to anybody in the Arab world, and they have their own correspondents, Walid al-Omari and in Israel, and they report on almost daily basis whatever happens, they report, and they would host Israelis to talk on their talk show. And this is really, really good. But at the same time, the message of Al Jazeera is still pan-Arabist. I mean, still a message of when it comes to Israel, there are a lot of mystification about this, especially when they bring every time Abdul Bari Atwan to talk about Israel. You know, and you know Abdul Bari Atwan, for example, and this Egyptian guy from Al-Musawwar, Bakri, Mustafa Bakri. And the guy really thinks that it is 1953 still. He doesn't know that we are in 2007, 2006. To broadcast in Hebrew, the Jordanian TV used to do it, by the way. Mm-hmm. And I had some research on Israel, how they received it. It was this unnoticed. No, because they don't speak Hebrew properly with a thick accent. Mm-hmm. And they speak it like the Sephardim, when the Sephardim is getting Ashkenazed now. You know, seriously, like, if you go, I mean, I was in the Hebrew University, like, you know, meeting the Ashkenazi say la'asot chayim, and the Sephardi Oriental la'asot chayim, like Arabs. And if you see their kids, like, you know, a Yemeni Jew, who say la'asot chayim, it's exactly like Ashkenazi. So at a time when the Israeli society is getting Ashkenazed, and the Arab is still broadcasting in the proper Hebrew, which is the Sephardi or the Oriental. So it's unnoticed, I would say.
Sure. Yeah, I think your point about journalism is very good, and it brings up the role of education. In other words, as journalism expands, and I applaud the fact that they have Israeli guests and so on, but it's also journalist training. Education for journalists, that is, once one of the values of area studies in general is to help develop a strong cadre of journalists, that they will gain expertise or gain a better understanding of, you know, all parts of the world. And so as the media enterprises become, you know, more focused on Israel, the need for educated correspondents, producers, etc., sort of reinforces the need for better education in this area. And the last thing I'll say is the question about the Holocaust in the diaspora, the Arab diaspora in Europe. What's interesting is that in France, Italy, and Spain, there's a real strong interest, and they're starting to use this in schools there and doing some teacher training programs, so that the education officials are very interested in this kind of thing for the very reason that you were talking about. So this could resonate in ways outside the immediate Arab world as well, which I think was the implication of your question.
Thank you.
Maybe I should download it then.
What's that?
Maybe I should download it then.
Yes, it's when it gets up electronically. Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Well, we're a little bit past two. I'd like to start by thanking Jeff for his comments. A special thanks to Hassan for a great presentation and to all of you for coming and for your questions. Thank you.